Welcome to episode number 41 of the Jackson Hole Connection, brought to you by the Liquor Store of Jackson Hole, happily serving the community of Jackson Hole and the surrounding valley for over 35 years. Please visit thejacksonholeconnection.com/TLS to learn more. Welcome to the Jackson Hole Connection. I'm Stefan Abrams, your host. I believe if you desire a truly fulfilling life, both personally and professionally, then you must be willing to find a connection with people outside of your everyday circle of influence, which is why I created the Jackson Hole Connection podcast. Today, you and I will hear from Michael Coles, the cookie guy. But Michael's life has been about much more than just cookies. That's just how his kids' friends knew him. Michael's been through a near-death experience, been bankrupt, did not attend an Ivy League college, yet he started working at the age of 13 and began learning the skills to succeed in life and business in the school of hands-on experience. Michael co-founded the Great American Cookie Company. He's the former CEO of Caribou Coffee, started two banks, and set three transcontinental cycling world records. Michael will share with us today how he faced life disruptions and business challenges, and his words, David beat Goliath. And we are all David, working on battling Goliath. Today is certainly one episode you don't want to miss. Michael, I was so excited when you accepted my invitation to be on the podcast, so thank you for being here today.
I'm excited.
So let's talk about where life brought you to Jackson Hole, because this is the Jackson Hole Connection. So when was the first time that you found out about Jackson Hole?
My first trip out west was in a rented motorhome with my two children at the time, and Donna, my wife. And we got stuck in Pinedale during a road outage, and we were stuck literally south of Pinedale for about 5 hours on the road. And our plan was to just drive through Jackson on our way to the park, just go get into the park. And because of that delay, we wound up spending the night here. And we just fell in love with Jackson. I mean, we just loved it. And this is like 1974. So it was a very different place back then.
I don't think there were many paved roads back then in Jackson.
I honestly don't even remember. But I remember just thinking how cool the city was at the time. And so when life was good, after life kind of became good for my wife and I, and we wound up buying a place in Montana, we used to come to Jackson, which we bought in 1987, that same year of the fire, which almost took our house that we bought. But we started coming over here every summer, and we would spend two weeks a summer here. And then I got involved with the Jackson Hole, One Fly, and this will be my 15th year doing that. And we just made so many friends here. This is I always tell people, you don't want to come to Jackson. It's really gone to hell in a handbasket, because I don't want any more people here. But this is probably the most, I don't think you could find any place more beautiful. I don't think you find any place with better people. And the whole community here is just everything you'd want in a big city without all the things you don't want in a big city.
We are very fortunate to be in this rural part of Wyoming and the rest of the country and have some of the resources that we have.
It's fabulous.
And I like what you said. It's the people.
It is, totally. I mean, and that's what we finally, it was 4 years ago now when we were leaving Jackson after the One Fly. And it probably helped that we had won that year. And so we were on our way back to West Yellowstone, and we had a great time. And my wife and I both looked at each other and said, why don't we live in Jackson? And literally within the next year, we moved.
It's fantastic. Yeah. Well, the community is much better now that we have you and Donna living here and participating in our community. So thank you.
Well, we love it.
I have had the opportunity to read your book, Time to Get Tough. And we'll talk about the book in a little bit. But I also want to talk about your history and your background. And you grew up in a working class family, and you had some real struggles there in life. And you've also had some remarkably fantastic successes in life as well. So tell us a little bit about what always kept you going in life, that you didn't let the actual parts of life that bring people down, it didn't bring you down. You kept going. Tell us what kept pushing you through.
So I would say until I was 10 years old, we were an upper middle class family. We certainly weren't rich, but by no means were we poor. I mean, we my brother, when he turned 16, he's 9 years older than me, my dad bought him a car, which today is common, but was not common back then. We lived in the suburbs in a home with a big backyard. And then when I was 10, my dad went bankrupt. And when he went bankrupt, I didn't even know at 10 what bankrupt was. But I didn't realize the change that would happen in our life. I came home from school. My parents had a panel truck in front of the house, which was loaded with all of our furniture and all of our possessions.
A paddle truck?
A panel.
Oh, a panel truck. Okay.
Yeah, a panel truck.
Okay.
And my dog, Lucky, I had a black cocker spaniel, and she was in my red wagon with her dog food in her bowl, and my parents basically had arranged, without me knowing it, to give my dog away because we were having to move out of the house. I had no idea that we were moving until I came home that day. And I was 10, they gave it to a house up the street to a kid that was 8, and so I couldn't be tearful because I had to be tough, you know, 8-year-old kid. I didn't want him to think I wasn't tough, so I took the dog up the street and gave her away and came back home and still didn't. To me, that's what bankruptcy was. Bankruptcy was you lose your dog.
Mm.
And so we moved to an apartment and we still had all of our stuff. And so it didn't feel that different. You know, we'd only lived in the house a few years. And my dad, who always believed he would recover from his bankruptcy, we wound up still living way above our means. And 3 years later, we literally moved in the middle of the night to Florida, which was a debtor state. So they couldn't garnish his wages because he was basically bringing home no money.
Oof.
And so we went to Florida. I thought, you know, at first we were moving to Florida. You know, we were living in Buffalo. I thought to myself, this is great. You know, palm trees, sun. And I'm thinking we're going to live kind of the same way. But when we got down there, we had none of our furniture, none of our household possessions. My parents had sold everything. And we moved to Miami Beach in about a 300-square-foot apartment, one bedroom. I had to share a bedroom with my sister. And my parents slept on a screen porch. And there was no air conditioning. And I literally woke up in the morning after we moved there. And I had two choices. I could accept the reality of what life was going to be like now, or I could believe my dad would rebound and that this was just a temporary situation. And I chose the first one, which was that this is not going to change. And so that day I went out and got a job. I was 13 and I wound up having three jobs, which I'd been a very good student. I became a very bad student because I never had time to study or do homework. And I wasn't working to buy toys or things for myself. I was virtually working and giving the money to my family.
Mm-hmm.
So to your question, I never fully understood what my dad went through until I started my first business, which was in 1972, and it went bankrupt 2 years after I started it, 2.5 years. And I remember blaming everybody in the business, that which was mine, for the business failing. And probably the greatest lesson I learned in my life was when I finally, you know, manned up and realized my responsibility in the business failing. And the lesson I took away from it was I probably would go back into business again and I would make mistakes, but I would never make the same mistakes. But most importantly, I had, for the first time in my life, I had the feeling, at least I think I had the feeling of what my dad must have gone through. It's the worst feeling I've ever had, that scary feeling of thinking you may lose everything. So when people ask me what has motivated me, it was never having that feeling again.
It's good motivation.
Yeah.
And a lot of people with great successes have at some point some failing moment, some moment which strikes them as, this is not what I want anymore.
So, you know, Bobby Jones, who's probably the greatest amateur golfer of all time, mm-hmm. had a great line that was, I never learned anything from a golf tournament I won.
Hmm.
You know, and I think for me, that's one of the things I try to pass on now as I mentor younger people and maybe some other people who are not so young or maybe in business and struggling a little bit, is that the greatest lessons you can have are things that don't go right. And the difference really between success and failure is how you deal with the unexpected. And, you know, I'm quoting people, but, you know, like Mike Tyson has a great line. He said, everybody has a fight plan until you get punched in the face. And then the fight plan goes out the window.
That's right.
You got to improvise.
You got to improvise. You got to adjust.
Exactly.
And looking back, when your first business went bankrupt, and at first you were blaming other people for it, what transitioned in your mind or in your thoughts that said, I now need to own this so I don't do this again?
That's it. That's exactly what it was. It was a wake-up call.
Okay.
To realize that, because I knew that I would go back into my own business, and I just realized that I had this great mentor when I was a kid, this guy Irving Settler, and Irving taught me some of the most important things about business, and one of them was, you don't have to be an expert in every aspect of your business, but you need to know about how every aspect of your business runs. And I had made the fatal mistake in my first business, which was called Pantomime, I was a great marketer, I was very, very good at merchandising, and I virtually paid no attention to the financial end of the business. I thought that revenue would cure everything, and it didn't. And by the time I woke up realizing that our margins were too slim, it was too late. And so when I finally kind of fessed up to the fact that I had broken that cardinal rule of Irving's, I went back and just, you know, looked at what my responsibility was. And it was more than that. It wasn't just that one simple thing of the financial end of the business, some bad hiring, you know, being, you know, overly loyal. I mean, it was just a lot of different mistakes. And when I started the cooking company, when we started that business with no money virtually, I mean, we couldn't afford to make any mistakes. And of course, in the book, it talks about the first day of the cookie company, which we almost went out of business the first day.
After I read that part of the book, I shared it with my wife because I was reading it just before bed and I hit that spot. And I was cracking up. And do you want to share with people what that was?
Sure.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Right. It's so we started the Great American Cookie Company with $8,000. We had no experience in the food business. Virtually the company should not have succeeded. We had a lot of trouble getting our first location, and we finally got a mall manager to take a leap of faith and give us a location. We had no money to advertise the opening, so we had our flyers around the neighborhoods around the mall, and that basically said from 9 o'clock in the morning till 12 noon, we would give away free cookies. We figured if we could get people to come and try the product, they would come back and then buy it. And we didn't know if anybody would even show up. But opening day on June 29th, we did show up. We had already bought all our equipment, so we were able to get the store built in a hurry. We got our first batch of cookies in the oven about 8:30 in the morning. And a quarter to nine, when the bell went off, those 300 cookies were sitting on their trays, golden brown. There were maybe 150 people out in the mall waiting for these 300 cookies to come out of the oven. And we went over to take the cookies out of the oven, and we opened up the oven door, and there those beautiful golden brown chocolate chip cookies were sitting there on their trays at 350 degrees, and we realized we had forgotten to buy pot holders or oven mitts, whatever you want to call them. And we had no rags in the store. We had no napkins in the store. We had no way to get the cookies out of the oven. People in the mall, there was a window on the front of the oven so people could actually watch the cookies baking as they went round and round. And, of course, they had no idea what was going on, but the cookies eventually went from golden brown to a much darker shade of brown to literally catching on fire in the oven. And we were on a combined air conditioning system with Park Lane Hosiery, which was next door. Smoke was pouring out of our oven into their store. They were people running out of their store screaming because they thought the mall was on fire. The fire department came. And I remember the mall manager, who was a guy named Jeff Weil, who took this big chance on us. I saw him coming through this cloud of smoke, looking towards the store, and thank God the gate was down. He couldn't get in. And he just asked one simple question: is this what it's going to be like every day, guys? And I think the important part of that story is that, think about what we had done. I had studied the business for 10 months. I had flown around the country and visited other cookie stores. We had bought all of our equipment. I thought we knew everything that we needed to be successful. And we literally could have been put out of business by a $3 set of oven mitts. Mm-hmm. And that's the great lesson that comes out of it. It's how do you deal with the unexpected? You know, we didn't get open that day. In fact, we had to go back out into the area where we passed out flyers and say, oops, we didn't open today, but we will open tomorrow. We will give away free cookies. And the best part of that, and I actually forgot to put this in the book, the best part of that, the next day, when we open, when we get ready to open, there must have been 500 people in the mall, because I'm sure they all came. It was like watching a traffic accident. What are these two idiots going to do today? Today, will they finally finish it? Will they just burn the mall down? And so people came from all over. And so we got off to a great start that next day.
That's hilarious. And I'm so thankful that you're able to share that story and laugh about it, because
wasn't funny at the time.
No, I'm sure it was not. I'm sure it was not funny at the time. I'll be right back with Michael after this quick message from the show's sponsor. Have you ever wondered how to make one of those cool cocktails you enjoyed at your favorite restaurant? Ever look at the wall of wine and wonder, why does all of this exist? Did you know beer and food can complement each other? Well, all of these answers and more can be discovered at the Liquor Store of Jackson Hole. The knowledgeable and friendly staff love making your experience one to remember. Please stop in to say hello to the fun and friendly staff and discover something new to make your taste buds dance. Visit thejacksonholeconnection.com/TLS for more details. You spent 10 months researching the cookie business. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you knew nothing about the food business, but you did research.
Right.
To say, I can do this.
Yeah.
And why do all that research? What pushed you to do that research versus saying, cookies, let's go do it?
Well, first of all, I thought I had a great cookie recipe, which was my mother's, which we wound up not using. We wound up using my partner's, Arthur Karp, his wife was Susan, and we wound up using her cookie recipe, which was passed down from about 5 generations. So it was a great recipe. But as I traveled around and looked at other cookie stores, I realized that most of the people that were in the business came out of the bakery industry. They were not retailers, and they were bakers. And I was not a baker. I was a retailer. And so I had a different twist on being in the cookie business. I had a different way of doing it. And the other thing was, a lot of people thought it would be a fad business, but I knew it was not a fad business because I did, back then, you know, I had to go to a library and use microfiche to figure out how big was the cookie business. It was over $2.5 billion in 1977.
$2.5 billion in 1977?
In cookies, yeah. Not you know, cookie stores, because there were only a few hundred cookie stores, and they weren't even registering in that number. But there was $2.5 billion, which did not count bakeries. It was all packaged cookies. It was $2.5 billion in the United States, not worldwide. And so my feeling was, this is not some, business that's just going to go away. If you can do this business right and you can tap into that $2.5 billion market, you could actually build a real business, mm-hmm. which was what we did. I mean, the big companies that were around when we started, there was a company that had almost 100 stores, two that had almost 50. By the time we had 100 stores, they were out of business.
Are you okay saying what those businesses were back then?
Sure. The biggest one was a company out of Chicago called the Cookie Factory. And they came from some bakery family. And they exploded on the scene. Mm-hmm. There was another one out of California called the Cookie Store. I'm sure they spent a fortune from some marketing firm to come up with that name, the Cookie Store. And then the third one was called the Original Cookie Company. Mrs. Fields started a month after we did, but we by far were the most successful.
And who came up with the idea of the cookie cake?
Me.
You did?
Yeah. So cookie cake came out of something I had done for my kids. One of the things, if you ever go to a kid's birthday party where they have a regular cake, you see a lot of icing being eaten, and you see a lot of half-eaten or partially-eaten cake, and there's always a lot of cake left over because kids virtually don't like cake. I mean, they may say they do, but they really don't. If you bring a cookie cake to a party, they'll eat the box. I mean, there's nothing left. They eat it all. And so I had done that for my kids. I had made with my mother's recipe these large cookie cakes and, you know, decorated them with just chocolate and white icing. And so we knew in the very beginning that we would never survive. We would never be around for very long if all we sold were individual cookies. You just couldn't. Remember the cookies when we started with 30 cents a piece? The mall rent was $25,000 a year. If you do the math, that's a lot of cookies, not counting utilities and salaries and everything else.
And fire insurance.
Yeah, fire insurance. And so what we realized, we had to change this being an impulse business to a destination business. And the only way to do that was to have a cake, a cookie cake, where people would either walk by and order it or call in and order it, and then they would have to make a trip as a destination to the mall. And while they were there, hopefully they'd buy some other cookies to take with them. And so that was the transformational difference between our business and everybody else that was out there.
The cookie cake. I love it. I worked for a caterer when we moved from Mississippi to New Orleans, and we made a lot of food for bar and bat mitzvah parties, and I made a lot of cookie cakes and decorated a lot of cookies with whatever candy was available.
Yeah, and you know, the company today is doing great. It's still doing really well, and I think that the reason it's around and has been so successful is because of the cookie cake. I mean, it's like, I can't tell you how many people I run into that say to me, I had a cookie cake from the time I was 5 years old at every single one of my birthdays. And the thing that's so cool is the company is now 42 years old. So some of those kids that were fives, mm-hmm. right? They're like 40 years old now. And I run into people like that all the time, especially because of the book. You know, I go around the country and people come, oh, I love the cookie cake. We had it every year. So
that's awesome. So let's fast forward to where you are now. And successful businesses started the Great American Cookie Company. And we'll add a little in there that you became involved in Caribou Coffee, became bought into Caribou Coffee, and then doubled the size of Caribou Coffee and actually took it public onto the NASDAQ. And now you're doing a lot of giving back to communities, a lot of philanthropy. You taught at Kennesaw State, and you've done lots of lecturing, and you've now written your book, Time to Get Tough. There's an organization benefiting from your book. You're giving so much back to everyone else. What's the driving force for all the give back?
Well, I talk about in the book, I grew up with the three W's, which is work, wisdom, and wealth. And I believe that every business, I believe that everybody, whether it's business or you're, you know, a professional of lawyer, doctor, banker, whatever you may be, everybody has an obligation to be a good corporate citizen. And I grew up, even when my family had no money, my mother would still make cookies or cakes and donate them to the PTA so they could have cake sales or cookie sales. My dad, which I didn't find out until much, much later, had a relationship with Boys Town and gave... My dad was back. My dad was in the business of recycling clothes. They don't do that anymore. But back in the day, that was a big business. You would recycle wool, recycle cotton, and it would be turned back into other materials that they would make clothes out of. And I guess that came probably after the war, World War II. But anyway, my dad would pick the best stuff out that looked really good, and he would donate it to Boys Town.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just kind of grew up with that idea that, you know, you need to give back to your community. When Don and I first got married, we didn't have any money, but we worked in organizations that we thought we might be able to help. Later on, as I was able to get on some boards and we had some money to share, I thought we gave him the second one, which is wisdom. I hope we gave him some wisdom, and then eventually wealth. But what I try to talk about in the book is that people sometimes feel like just giving a donation to something, that's where it ends. And the thing that they have to realize is that most nonprofits could never afford the talent that some of the people that are in businesses or professionals can give advice to a nonprofit. And so I always say it's too easy to write a check and then just walk away. I say that write the check, but also give them your time and help them. If you believe in the institution, then help them become better at what they do. That's why when we first moved to Jackson, Don and I both decided, well, what do we want to do here? Where can we help? And so I joined the hospital, the medical center foundation board. I was very glad that they allowed me, to become a part of that. Yeah, but the book, all of the money from the book goes to Kennesaw State University. My wife and I were very fortunate to endow the business school, which bears my name, and that's another one. I mean, we did that in 1994, and I've been on the board of Kennesaw State University since 1990, and I'm still on the board, and still on the executive committee, and I'm headed up now. Now I'm heading up the nominating committee, because we're going through a transformational stage and we need to bring a lot of new blood onto the board. And so, I don't know, it's like people say, what keeps you busy these days? Well, I mean, it's giving back. I mean, and it's not like I feel bad about that. I feel fortunate to be able to do it. Because honestly, helping the lives of people that you'll never meet is probably the most gratifying thing you can ever do, especially in a place that has given me so much. And I'm talking about America as a whole. I mean, I would never, ever have thought from where I started that I could have the life that I have today, and it can only happen in this country.
Thank you for sharing that story. What I love about it is, even though growing up your family did not have financial resources, you all still found a purpose and a way to give back to the community, because it allowed you to be involved in the community, but there's always somebody else who needs. And I think that with people in society today, I think we can all take a little reflection and realize that we can always offer something to an organization.
Absolutely.
Or to a person.
Yeah. I mentor a lot of millennials. Not a lot, but I mean a half a dozen or so millennials. Back in Georgia, and I always come away from those coffees or lunches learning more than I think I could ever have given, because this whole millennial group that we're involved that are in business today, they just think completely differently than I did, and in a good way, I think. People worry about what's going to happen. There's nothing to worry about. The millennials that I deal with have a perspective on everything we've just talked about, including giving back, and having a life that is very involved in the community, from the environment to healthcare to all kinds of things. It's been very interesting for me.
I'm glad that you are learning from a younger generation as well, because when you do that, when you're talking to other people, you can help share that information
sure.
as well.
Yeah.
And I think it just shows that no matter where we are in our lives, there's always something to learn. Always something to learn. Your book, Time to Get Tough, you talk about a lot of this, a lot of the topics and information that you've touched on right now. How can people find your book, Time to Get Tough?
Well, let me give you the full title, because it's Time to Get Tough, and the subtitle is How Cookies, Coffee, and a Crash Led to Success in Business and Life. And the reason I bring that up is there is another book out by a different author called Time to Get Tough.
Okay. Thank you.
So, give you the whole title. It's on Amazon. It's available on Amazon. It's available here in Jackson at the local bookstore. But yeah, it's available in Kindle as well if you want to just download it to a phone or an iPad or whatever you have, or a Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
It is available. Book's done well. It's gotten very good reviews. Very proud of it.
As you should be. And I think for people listening today, if they're not sure what direction they're going in life, I think they can, from me reading it, I feel everybody can take a little nugget of information and apply it to their lives, no matter where they are in their lives. And I really appreciate you sharing your story in this book, because it's real life.
Well, the one thing I'll say is, you know, there's a lot in there about business, but it's really about the business of life.
Mm-hmm.
The book, I didn't write this book to boast. I wrote this book to hopefully motivate people to find some strength in themselves that they might not have thought they had. I know that that's been something for me, that throughout the course of my life, I've had to overcome some things that made me stronger. There's a great line, you know, stronger in the broken places. And I know that for me, that's been a big benefit, is finding strength that perhaps I didn't know I had, that was caused by something that was pretty bad, but you learn to overcome it. So that was the purpose for the book. I mean, sure, there are people that are in business that perhaps will benefit from it. But I think, you know, the theme that runs through the book is the story of David and Goliath. There's a Goliath theme that runs all the way through the book. And that story is a true story for me. After I realized when my dad went bankrupt and I realized that my life was going to be very different, I looked for a source of strength, something of some story about overcoming adversity. And I remember going back to the story of David and Goliath, and it was never for me that David, this small man that walked into the valley and not only defeated the giant, but killed the giant, that was never my takeaway. My takeaway was always that this small man going in to face this enormous giant had the courage to take the first step and walk into the valley. And I think for people, hopefully if they read this book, they'll realize that everybody, every single day, goes through Goliath challenges, you know, whether it's changing jobs, going back to school, going through a divorce, having a health issue that you've got to fight, whatever they are, those are Goliath challenges. And the real question we have to ask ourselves every single day is, do we have the courage to step into the valley, take that first step?
So true. So true. And I know every day with me operating businesses that Goliath is always out there. And being able to show up makes such a difference. And I appreciate the history and the thoughts and the insight that you put in there. And I like the correlation between David and Goliath. It certainly resonated with me a lot. You just talked about the business of life. So we have working, and then we have the business of life. How did you balance being a good father and husband, but also being a good business person, a successful business person?
Well, I know that there have been a lot of opportunities along the way that I probably passed on because my first marriage failed. It's in the book. I mean, it just failed. And when I met Donna, I was absolutely confident that this marriage was not going to fail. And I, again, did a lot of self-evaluation of why my first marriage failed, and I was not going to make the same mistake again. And so I would say that I've made almost every decision since then regarding family and business and how you balance it, family first. And it's worked. And I would also say that, you know, in the book, which we didn't touch on, you know, we talk about, you know, burning the cookies and forgetting oven mitts, but, you know, 6 weeks after we started the company, I had a near-fatal motorcycle accident, and I was told that I would basically never walk again unaided. And so that was a reality check in itself, because I joke about it a lot, but I could have just as easily have been killed in that accident. And even though Donna and I, we had only been married at that point 5 years, that was also a moment to take a step back and assess everything for yourself, you know, and decide how do you want to go forward. And the reason I went into the cookie business was for that reason. I had small kids. The clothing industry was moving overseas. I could have stayed in it. I could have been very stuck. I was successful in it, and I could have stayed in it. But the quality of my life, having to travel to Asia, you know, 3 weeks a month, which is what I would have had to do, there's no way I would have seen my kids grow up. And I just made the decision to get out of this. Now, honestly, I didn't expect the cookie business to be my business. I really thought that I would probably wind up in some form of clothing, you know, different than what I was doing. But when I had my motorcycle accident, all those options were taken away because I couldn't walk. Mm-hmm. And so by the time I could walk, we had about, you know, 25 or 30 stores. And I literally woke up one morning and said, well, maybe this is what I'm supposed to do. And so I started focusing on the business. And it was a great business because it allowed me to be at home. You know, the kids loved the fact that I was the cookie guy, you know. I mean, my kids grew up, you know, having cookies, I mean, everywhere in their lives. So it was, the balance was easy to do once I made the decision to get away from the business I had grown up in. And I did grow up, and I started in the clothing business when I was 13.
Mm-hmm. So, was that tough to come to the realization that moving away from the clothing business and transition into a business where family was going to be the priority?
No. And the reason it was that I realized that I loved the business, mm-hmm. and that everything I had learned in the clothing business, from being a manufacturer to being a retailer, or I could say from being a retailer to a manufacturer, it all translated. Mm-hmm. Every manufacturing is manufacturing. Whether you're manufacturing clothing or manufacturing batter to make cookies, it's the same thing. The processes are all about, you know, like piece goods or raw materials, same thing, comes in one end. It goes through a facility where they're either sewing stuff together or mixing stuff together, and then it goes to shipping. And you're either putting it in a refrigerated warehouse or you're putting it on shelves. So that part of my knowledge was so transferable that it worked when I went to Caribou as well. I'm understanding now it's just roasting. Same thing. Green comes in bags. It goes through a roasting facility, and then it's got to go out the door. And so I realized that what I really loved was building a team and having a vision for what a business could be, and translating that to that team and getting them to be the best that they could be. That's what I really love. And so, it turned out to be, like I said, you're right though. In the beginning, I thought, well, how am I going to do this? You know, but as I realized it was all the same. And that's kind of like when I got into the banking business, which I'm now out of, but when I got into the banking business, same thing. It was customer service, how to build customer experience. And that's really what I grew up learning from Irving, was customer experience. And in the book, I have that, what I call the customer-centric equation, which is P plus E plus S equals capital E small f, which stands for product plus environment plus service equals the experience factor. So what you could say is my life is pretty simple. It's all around that one equation that basically has guided me my whole life.
I think a lot of our lives can be based upon or around something that's pretty simple. I mean, look at Einstein. E equals MC squared.
Hey, I wasn't trying to, you know.
No, not at all. Yeah. But I think if we all take time to reflect on and give ourselves time to reflect, that we can realize that life is simple, with all of the outside noise that's available in the world, we can still have simple life and live a good life.
Yeah, and the formula for when I was a caribou, which is where I brought the formula out for the first time, it was great because we had a lot of young people who weren't far away from taking algebra. And it was easy to explain to them that in any algebraic formula, if you change one part of it, you don't get the same answer. And so it wasn't a question of giving a customer a great product in a great environment, but, you know, really lousy service, or give them great service and a clean environment and a really crappy product. You had to do all three all the time. And that was such a great teaching tool for people to understand. And I've had friends of mine in all kinds of other businesses that have taken that formula now and are using it. Makes me very proud, by the way.
That's spectacular. Yeah. And thank you for sharing that information. Not everybody's willing to share what has driven their success. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what makes you so special and wonderful, is you are sharing that because you want to see other people succeed.
Absolutely.
And so one final question for you. When you're running these businesses and you had to make some tough decisions about how the businesses were operating to get them to be very vibrant and lively. How much time in your business day would you take to reflect, be out of all the minutiae of things? How much time would you take to reflect about what needed to be done for the business?
Well, I would say that as a CEO of a company, that had to be the majority of what I should be doing and what I ultimately try to do. You know, the thing about businesses is that they have to constantly be reinvented, because no matter how good you are, if you come up with a great product or a process, you've got to remember you have competition. And one of the points I always try to make with people, if you come out with a great new process and you execute it really well, that's the starting point of your competition. Your competition is going to see what you've done, and they're not going to do the same thing. They're going to do that and better. And so you've got to constantly stay ahead of that. And I always felt that my job was to constantly break the business down and find the places in which we could do better than we were doing. I mean, the one thing that'll kill you in business is thinking, it's like golf. If you ever think that you've got the game down, you know, it's not, there's a lot of great analogies about golf and business, which is you never win at golf. You just play golf. It's different every time you go out there. It's kind of like fly fishing. You never really know what's going to happen when you go. And it's really the same way in business, is that the minute you think you own anything about your business, you got to remember, this is from Irving, who told it to me when I was 14 years old, the day I said to him, these people love us, we own them. And he looked at me and he said, kid, just remember, there's 50 people standing in the wings waiting to take this business away from us. And we've got to make sure we treat every customer with respect, treat them well, give them a great experience. And for me, that's what business is about. You've got to look deep into everything that you're doing and make sure that you not only do it well at the moment, you do it well for the future. You innovate, you change things to make it work.
I love it. I will take those words and use them every day, not just for business, but also for life and living my life as a father and a husband as well, because I think we can always apply those as being family people as well.
I agree.
Yeah. Yep. Michael, this is spectacular. I can't thank you enough for coming and joining me today and sharing your story. And I really encourage people to look at their local bookstore for Time to Get Tough, How Cookies, Coffee, and Crash Led to Success in Business and Life, or go on to Amazon and also leave a review. Give some feedback so other people know how the book has helped them and helped them reflect about life and business.
Well, let me just say this before signing off, Stephan. Mm-hmm. First of all, I appreciate you having me on the show, and I mean that because it's another example of how welcoming this community is. And to have the opportunity to share this story with the community, as well as you're inviting me here, means a lot to me. So thank you.
Yes, sir. My pleasure. It's an honor. Well, go make it a great day out there. Thank you. To learn more about Michael and his book, visit my website, thejacksonholeconnection.com, episode number 41. I love hearing from my listeners and subscribers. So if you have feedback or suggestions, please send an email to connect@thejacksonholeconnection.com. Please remember, when you're in Jackson Hole, to be sure to visit my friends at the Liquor Store of Jackson Hole. I could not create this podcast without the support of my wife, Laura, my editor, Michael Morey, my musical director, Luke Taylor, and my marketing guru, Tana Hoffman. I sure hope you have enjoyed this episode, and I look forward to seeing you back for the next episode of the Jackson Hole Connection.